Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. I'm your host, Jayden Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Tyler Woodward.
How are we doing today, Jayden?
Doing well.
Today, we're going to talk to you about how to mitigate the stresses of exercise.
And this episode of the Thermo Diet Podcast is brought to you by Zoom, Umzu's premier pre-workout supplement, designed with a lot of the ideas that we're talking about in today's episode in mind. So let's get into it.
Yeah, so without further ado, so when we exercise, there's basically two types of stressors. Basically, there's the eustress or intentional stress. These are the things that we're going to the gym to induce to the purposeful stress that we want to create. And there's the unintentional stress. So that's going to be things that are just additional byproducts of working out or exercising and just life in general. And these are things that, if we can, we want to mitigate because they don't have any additional benefits to getting stronger, faster, healthier, and whatnot. So when we have, we'll call it eustress or the good stress or intentional stress, whatever you want to call it, these are basically things that are going to result in beneficial adaptations that occur in the body. So that's going to be like getting stronger, increased protein synthesis, increased glycogen stores, potentially hormonal things like testosterone, progesterone increases, and then things like, anything else I'm missing?
Maybe just like the dose-dependent nature of them. So like the amount of eustress that we get from exercise is beneficial up to a point. And then anything that is kind of beyond that point, kind of like that limit, so to speak, is going to be diminishing returns. Mm-hmm.
And at which point I would say it probably is no longer eustress, right?
Right.
So it's the balance of finding that the amount of stress that allows you to incrementally make gains over time and progress without decreasing your health.
Yeah. I like to think about it as like the minimum effective dose. What's the least amount of work that I can do to get the highest return on what I'm doing?
100%. Time investment too.
Yeah, definitely. For sure.
And so then we have distress, which is basically things that don't really have any intrinsic value. They're kind of just negative all around. And so the primary one that I think of is going to be leaky gut. So exercise-induced leaky gut is a pretty well-known phenomena. And it happens basically most often in cardiovascular type events where you're running and your gut is shaking around. And typically when you exercise, blood flow travels to your organs and your muscles away from your gut. So it allows the gut to become more permeable to that bad bacteria, endotoxin or lipopolysaccharides, which when they leak through, they cause an inflammatory reaction in the body.
Yeah, it's super interesting because like this is one of the reasons that like long distance endurance training is going to be not necessarily good for your health. Like there's some psychological benefits that you could argue that would kind of outweigh the negative response from it. But if you look at these like ultra marathon runners and stuff like that, like they have the cortisol response that comes with that is typically going to be chronic because like they're exposing themselves for long amounts of time during their running, but then also afterwards, it takes them a lot of effort to be able to turn that sympathetic nervous system off and then get back into a healing state, so to speak. So I would argue that they actually spend a lot more time in the sympathetic state than they do in the parasympathetic state.
Yeah. And if you look up exercise-induced leaky gut, the first thing that comes up is these endurance trainers. And I don't think they necessarily know, a lot of these articles know what leaky gut is. They just think it's like all the digestive issues, which it could be very well be related to what these endurance trainers are having. But endurance trainers, I think, notoriously have digestive issues, which makes sense when you're going for a 20-mile run without going to the bathroom. But so like what's really happening is, like we said, these gut junctions are being opened up and food particles can slip in and bacteria. And this is causing this inflammatory response. Also, obviously, there's this cortisol adrenaline aspect, which so basically the idea, and which Jayden was talking about a little bit, is the idea of chronic versus acute stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it, like whenever Tyler mentions gap junctions, he's basically the stomach lining is kind of like a netting, so to speak. And you want that netting, like the holes in that netting, to be as tight as possible to let in very small molecules that aren't going to trigger an autoimmune response or something like that. Whereas if these openings in the gut lining kind of open up too much, then you can have larger molecules like gluten, for instance, is one that causes a lot of leaky gut, can cause an autoimmune reaction for a lot of people. You also have like more endotoxin release into the system and stuff like that. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about the gap junctions.
Yeah. I'd imagine that like a knitted blanket where it's like a yarn, and then during at rest, it's pretty tightly knitted. But during exercise, it gets more and more pulled apart, and those holes get a little bit bigger, and then things can leak through. This is a normal phenomenon. It happens all the time. It happens throughout the day too. It just accentuated during these exercise and happens a lot more during exercise. So it's just the degree of gut permeability or leaky gut that's happening. But so I think we should go back to the chronic versus acute stressors. So, and this has to do with that same idea of eustress and distress. We need cortisol. We need adrenaline. We need growth hormone, all of these estrogens, probably serotonin in some way, to grow, to make these adaptations get stronger, faster. The emphasis, though, is that we need them acutely. We need a little dose. We need the dose makes the poison, and we need them to turn off after the workout so we can recover from that. And the issue with these long cardiovascular dominant typically work is that they're on for very elevated amounts of time, very long amounts of time, and it's hard to get them to turn off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like this can happen with any type of cardiovascular exercise, not just the endurance training. Mm-hmm. That's just one that is most commonly seen in a lot of the research. A good example of a different kind of cardiovascular training would be fighting. Like one of the MMA like greats, George St. Pierre, he had extreme digestive issues.
Like, oh, really?
His digestion was absolutely wrecked whenever he was at the top of his game. Like, I think whenever he came back in 2017 and won the title against, I believe it was Michael Bisping, John Danaher, who was his grappling coach at the time, said that that was one of the worst camps that he had ever been through with an athlete, because George, he just, like, there were certain points to where he just couldn't train because his digestion was so bad. Like, it was just torn up. I think he had diverticulitis or something like that, just a lot of inflammatory issues with his intestine that he now claims was cured by intermittent fasting and stuff like that, which has helped. But a lot of it has to do with his training regimen too. Mm-hmm.
He's on the carnivore diet now, or carnivore plus fruit. Mm-hmm. So pretty much pro-metabolic diet.
Right, yeah.
So when we're talking about these stressors, it's important to get the most of the stressors we want, like that acute bout of cortisol and adrenaline, without having it stay for too long. So let's talk about things that are going to mitigate that or help to, I guess, get the most bang for your buck.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about pre-workout, then like intra-workout, and then post-workout.
Okay. So pre-workout, my go-to favorites are glycine. So glycine helps to basically seal those gap junctions. Remember that knitted blanket analogy helps tighten them up. L-theanine does a very similar thing because it produces a glutamine, both are involved in the intestinal lining or the mucosal lining, help to basically get that layer of glue in there, help to seal everything up together. So those are going to help mitigate the negative stressors that we don't want, the distress that isn't really doing anything for us. Then we have things like caffeine. Caffeine may also do a similar thing, but it's just going to really, it acts like thyroid hormone. So it's extremely beneficial all across the board. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, not necessarily. I would say that the stimulants before workout are going to be more beneficial, in my opinion, if you are working out earlier in the day, just because a lot of the stimulants later in the day are going to affect your sleep. So it might be most beneficial to have the stimulants early in the day if you're working out earlier in the day, and then maybe go for like a stimulant-free pre-workout regimen later mm-hmm. in the day.
Yeah, if stimulants bother you, for sure, it's something to take into consideration. They personally don't really bother me. I can drink coffee to like 4 or 5 and go to sleep fine. I do try and limit it around like 3, which is typically when I work out. Especially if I'm not working out, I don't want to have it after like 2 or 3. But if I'm working out, I can get away with it. But that brings up another great point. Some pre-workout carbs. Mm-hmm. Very important. A, you're going to optimize your glycogen stores, your stored glucose levels. You want to tap that off so you can dip into it when you exercise as much as possible. And this will also eliminate the stress reaction. So one of the main things, one of the reasons this chronic endurance training is so bad is because you're primarily burning fat as fuel, versus in the short duration, intense exercise, you burn through your glycogen stores, your glucose stores very fast, which neither is good or bad, but the stored glucose burned through that increases a lot of CO2 in your body. And CO2 is basically like an antioxidant. It increases your metabolic rate. It's a vasodilator, so it opens up your arteries to flow more blood flow, more glucose, more oxygen. It's a lot of times you can consider it the product of cellular respiration along with ATP, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so by using consuming carbs before your workout, you can optimize CO2 production.
Right, definitely. And then on top of that, lactic acid too.
Lactic acid. So lactate happens when basically the cells get stuck or the electrons get stuck in the electron transport chain and they start to accumulate. So your body starts to produce lactate from pyruvate instead of converting pyruvate into ATP and all that stuff, keeping it going down the chain. So lactate is basically your cell's way of continuing to produce energy, but it's a lot less efficient. So when you don't have enough carbs or B vitamins, which are another important aspect of a good pre-workout, in my opinion, because those B vitamins are going to be rate limiting factors. So if you don't have enough B vitamins, your ability to use glucose as fuel will be limited. Those are also going to, as an effect, decrease the amount of lactate that's produced.
Mm-hmm. And like this is also going to be for like short bursts of exercise. Endurance training, you know, there's a lot of different nuances that we could talk about there. But most of the stuff that we're talking about is going to be for resistance type of training, mm-hmm. or like very short bursts of training, like sprints. Stuff like that.
Yeah, for sure. And that's why we are huge fans of the short duration training, because they tend to be more beneficial from using glucose as energy and for fuel, and also just minimizing cortisol, adrenaline, because these longer duration exercises are primarily going to burn fat, which releases a lot of CO2, means more adrenaline is being released to mobilize the fat. Same thing with the cortisol, and probably more lactate as well, just because there's less CO2 being produced. So CO2 and lactate are on that opposite spectrum.
So what are the things that you're doing pre-workout to mitigate the amount of lactic acid during the workout?
For short duration or long duration or both?
I guess we could talk about both, but mostly like the resistance training and stuff.
Yeah. So any kind of buffer. So basically buffers help to maintain either the cellular or blood acidity level. So as you know, if your blood gets too acidic, you pretty much throw up and you vomit. If your blood gets too basic, I think you can faint. Is that what happens? Too basic? Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Either way, not good. You have a very small window of how acidic or basic your blood has to be. It has to be like, I think it's 7.2 is it typical?
I do not know the
blood pH. I think it's 7.2. I could be wrong. Doesn't really matter. It's just very small range. So you can, anything with bicarbonate, your body naturally has a buffering system that makes bicarbonate salts that help to neutralize CO2 and potentially lactate or lactic acid. And then I like beta-alanine, so sodium bicarbonate or baking soda, and then magnesium bicarbonate are very good to mitigating lactic acid. And then beta-alanine is an intracellular buffer, and creatine is also an intracellular buffer. So it helps to basically help you get a couple extra reps and mitigate the accumulation of lactic acid or lessen the accumulation of lactic acid.
For the creatine, though, do you usually take that pre-workout?
No, so beta-alanine I'll take pre-workout. Creatine, it's more just like getting it in there. It's a kind of it doesn't really matter when you take it as long as the gas tanks are full.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so saturation over time matters more than necessarily during the day timing.
Yeah, beta-alanine probably honestly is a similar thing, but I think beta-alanine is just so you get a more immediate effect from it,
mm-hmm.
versus creatine you don't as much.
Mm-hmm.
So you could take creatine pre-workout, but it wouldn't be a huge deal whether or not you take a pre-workout.
What are the doses for a lot of these things that you're taking pre-workout?
So beta-alanine, I think you can get away with as low as like maybe 1,000 milligrams or a gram to, I would even say maybe 500 milligrams, depends how much you want, to like 2.5 to 5 grams. I think it's called, what is it, paresthesis? The really tingly feeling you get when you take beta-alanine.
Oh, I didn't know that's what it was called, but
I think it's called paresthesis. Maybe I'm just making all this stuff up. a lot of people don't like that. I've taken it a couple times. I don't mind it, but I've never taken like 5 grams. I think the most I took was like 2.5 grams. It's an interesting feeling. I don't think it has any negative consequences as far as I know, but some people, I know Brenton hated it. Mm-hmm. it's just kind of like awkward. You kind of feel like, I don't know. It's just, you got to try it yourself.
You're just kind of itchy. It kind of makes your skin feel like it's crawling.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I don't really know what that's from, but it's just one of the effects of it. Not necessarily good or bad, but it is what it is.
I think it's similar to the flushing effects of niacinamide.
Is it?
I think so.
Okay. I haven't seen anyone say that it was negative, though, but maybe that's just because Ray Pete hasn't talked about it.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a negative response. It's just a typical response.
Okay, interesting. And as far, so And those are things, the difference between the short duration workouts, where it's, so lifting and the longer duration stuff, or even like jiu-jitsu, where Jade and I both do, or skiing, is that I don't want any of the adaptations really from skiing or jiu-jitsu. And then Jade is the same. Like, we want to get better at the skill of doing those sports, but we don't necessarily want our body to adapt to the endurance style of training.
Right, yeah. We don't necessarily want to make the metabolism more efficient. We want to keep the wasteful metabolism so we can tend to, so you expel the excess energy that you're producing versus holding on and utilizing the low amount of energy that you're producing. So a lot of people, especially with chronic cardiovascular exercise, they're making their metabolism more efficient over time. So it's going to be more particular with what it's doing with the energy that it's producing versus having a wasteful metabolism where all of the excess energy that you're producing is going to be given off as heat. That's one of the reasons that like the core body temperature is such an important marker for where your metabolic rate is because the more energy that you're producing at the cellular level, the more heat that you're going to produce with your core body temperature.
So CO2 as well. CO2, heat, ATP, energy, all, and water, all are going together with that. And then would you say that like endurance training is basically train your body to do more with less?
Yeah, I would say that. That's probably a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's trying to like, it's kind of like, I hate this word, but you hate it too, probably starvation mode. Mm-hmm. Like it's getting your body really good at minimizing its burning of fuel. Mm-hmm. And we want to burn as much energy as possible. This is basically, we can talk about it very briefly, like the rate of living theory. Basically, it's the theory that you have a set number of heartbeats and you want to slow that down as much as possible versus the bioenergetic theory, which is you want to maximize the amount of energy your cells have so they can continually build and repair. There's no, we're not machines that just wind down over time and get broken down, basically.
Right. Like the structure and order of the organism is energy dependent. Mm-hmm. So the amount of complexity that you're able to produce, whether it is at the cellular level or even psychologically, the more energy that you have to spare for that, the more order and structure and complexity that can take place.
100%. So you want to talk about intra-workout?
Yeah, I honestly don't do much intra-workout. Most of the stuff that I do is like intra-workout carbohydrates and intra-workout electrolytes. So usually that looks like an adrenal cocktail. So I'm going to have the coconut water and the orange juice for the potassium and the carbohydrates. Add a little bit of salt to that to replenish the salt that I'm losing during the workout. And then, you know, I might take a little bit of magnesium before I do a workout too, just to ensure that my levels are topped off.
Yeah, I think that was a big one we forgot about pre-workout. Electrolytes are awesome. And getting some protein in as well, just to mitigate that stress reaction, so you're breaking down less protein. But electrolytes, I think sodium, magnesium is bound to ATP. So if you want energy, you need magnesium. Calcium helps your muscles to contract. Same thing with potassium. And then sodium is very important just because it basically monitors your blood fluid level, blood volume level. So if you want good blood flow, you need enough sodium. Mm-hmm. I would say those are probably a little bit more important pre and post workout because you want to get them in for to optimize the workout and then you want to recover from them. But they're also very good to get intra workout as well. And then carbs. I think consuming adrenal cocktail is great. I just do lemonade. I think it's very light, easy. It helps you to keep blood sugar up basically, which helps you to increase your CO2 production. Basically helps you to keep using glucose as fuel versus your cells running out and having switched to fat.
Mm-hmm. I would say that's one general principle that you need to look at whenever you're looking to mitigate stress overall is to keep your blood sugar at a good level. Like, you don't want your blood sugar to dip because that dip in blood sugar is what is going to cause like the adrenal release of cortisol, adrenaline, all that stuff.
Yes, sir. And that brings me to, this isn't necessarily like something you take, but nasal breathing. So if you are someone that's trying to recover from or improve your health, I may not go past the point of that you have to breathe through your nose. I may not use mouth breathing. When you're skiing or doing jiu-jitsu, it gets very hard because those are very cardiovascular intensive. But if this is something you can continually work towards over time, I think it's extremely beneficial. We were talking about this a couple weeks ago when I was reading The Oxygen Advantage by Patrick McCown. So we aren't generally huge fans of endurance training, but we love CO2, right? And like people, Ray P talks about like CO2 baths, sodium bicarbonate to increase CO2, all these things. And if you could theoretically do nasal breathing, so there's these Mexican endurance trainers, or not endurance runners, like this ancient tribe that's in Mexico, that they all nasal breathe. They run like miles and miles for hunting. And they're basically just giving themselves a CO2 bath, right? Because their tissues are, the amount of CO2 production is continually increasing. And they're retaining all that CO2, but not offloading it through mouth breathing. So mouth breathing, you basically, you breathe out too much CO2 relative to the amount of oxygen. So your cells are actually able to use less oxygen because they give off less CO2. Basically, it's like a trade. If you want your cells to absorb oxygen, they have to give off CO2 one-to-one. So the benefits of endurance training could be very much changed if people are nasal breathing through it.
Mm-hmm. And the loss of CO2 is what actually produces the hypoxic state, correct? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So losing too much CO2 by mouth breathing is going to increase lactic acid, probably decrease fatty acid, or increase fatty acid oxidation, burning fat fuel versus glucose. So the benefits of skiing, jiu-jitsu, running, and distance training could very much be at least much less detrimental, and I would say even potentially positive, if you're retaining all that CO2, because it's like you're giving your body a whole CO2 bath.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What do you do post-workout?
Post-workout, get some carbs, so replenish those glycogen stores.
Protein.
I like a little bit of collagen. Collagen is very anti-inflammatory. It has that glycine again. It helps with leaky gut. You can look at caffeine, depending on when you're working out, because it helps to increase your glycogen stores.
Mm-hmm.
So it means you're going to store less as fat.
And like the reuptake of glucose, right?
Oh, yeah. Burning more glucose for fuel. It's just going to help recover.
Yeah. I would say post-workout, like caffeine along with something that's going to help with insulin sensitivity in general is going to be a good glucose disposal agent. So basically help you restore the amount of the glucose that you lost during the workout a little bit more efficiently.
You're a big fan of berberine, right?
Yeah, I do. So like our product Sensolin, I'll take that post-workout with the meal sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then like the next day, like the pump is just awesome. So yeah. I do like to do that every once in a while.
Yeah, I should start trying that out again. I was doing it for a while. It was Redwood, Zoom, and Sensolin. Crazy pumps. And then I'm pretty much just getting a meal in, hydrating. I like milk a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that helps you relax.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I usually try to get a meal in as soon as possible. I'm not necessarily into the anabolic window theory, although there is a little bit of validity in there. I don't necessarily stress about it whenever I can't eat as soon as possible mm-hmm. after a workout, but it's definitely preferred, and it's usually a good mix of that's usually whenever I'll have most of my starches for the day, because they tend to digest a lot quicker. So that's usually when I'll have like my rice or my potatoes, stuff like that. And then I'll usually have like my main protein meal after working out too.
Yeah, I'd say the anabolic window is really just like the insulin sensitive window.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue with this, so like basically you can get away with eating the most amount of pretty much energy, but primarily glucose and carbs. And it's just going to be absorbed, burned as fuel or replenish your glycogen stores. You're able to burn more calories than any time throughout the day, it's because you're basically your body's starving for glucose, so it wants a lot of it. It's able to use a lot of it, and that can also help to increase muscle protein synthesis and whatnot. Question is like, how long does it last after the workout? Do you need to get it in right away? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest benefit of eating after your workout is probably just to get out of the stress sympathetic state back into the parasympathetic state.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe some like red light exposure, doing something that's very easy. Maybe even taking a nap. I knew I talked to this one guy who he would eat and then he would take a nap after his workout, which is like honestly great. He's probably getting an awesome hormonal response from that, and his recovery is probably phenomenal.
Yeah, for sure. And then you can also look at something like eating a daily carrot, maybe not post-workout, but it will also help just help detoxify your gut, help get things moving. Just things that optimize your gut health will be very good. Anything you recommend?
For gut health? I would say, you know, definitely figure out things that you don't respond to well, like things that either slow your digestion down, like constipate you and stuff like that. Probably figure out why those are having that effect on you, like, for some reason, it might be milk for some people, or like for others, it might be, I don't know, some kind of like potatoes or something. Mm-hmm. So maybe figure out why that's constipating you, and then figure out how you can either cook that food in a way that is going to stop doing that, or just eliminate that food entirely and replace it with something else that's not going to be affecting you that way. I would say that's probably my biggest tip, is just figuring out what your main like intestinal triggers are, I would say.
Yeah. And then obviously there's sleep. So eating some carbs, I think we should treat sleep like pre-workout a little bit. It's like get your body ready to go to town, go to war, recover as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to be fasting for 8 to 9 hours. So prepare your body for that fasting period too.
That's a great point too. It's like prepare your body to go without food. What would be, if you can't eat the next 12 hours, what would you want your body to have?
Mm. Is that a question that you're asking me, or is it just a statement?
I just kind of proposed it, but you can answer it.
For me, I definitely like to have ice cream before bed. That one's just like, it tastes really good. So it kind of has that psychological boost there. And then like sugar itself, like the sweetness, the taste, like just the taste of sweetness is able to help have like an anti-stress response. That's one of the that's also one of the reasons that a lot of artificial sweeteners and like, you know, potentially stevia and stuff like that, whenever you have those without the carbohydrates, it will actually create a stress response, because there isn't any fuel to back up the rest and digest.
Yeah. I think I'm not 100% sure. I think some of that may have been debunked about the artificial sweeteners. I'm not confident in that. You could be 100% right, but I've seen some BioLane and them are having some huge controversy these days, and they just love their artificial sweeteners.
Yeah. It really depends. I would say that like, if you're gonna have an artificial sweetener and for the taste specifically, maybe back that up with a little bit of carbohydrates, so there is something that's following up that taste. I think that
would be beneficial. I mean, in my opinion, it's just like the artificial sweeteners don't have any benefits, and sugar does have some benefits. So if you don't want to consume the excess calories, that's fine. Go with some artificial sweeteners, but make sure you're getting at least some sugar in as well, as you said. And anything else? Oh, so one last point I'd like to summarize, or do you have anything else for?
On top of the ice cream, sometimes I'll also get in some protein before I go to bed too. Maybe something that's slow digesting, like some casein or something like that. And then, yeah, usually I'll, you know, have some orange juice or something like that by the bed.
And I think not eating right before bed is very beneficial. And if you are going to eat before bed, do something that's very easily digested, like ice cream, especially for Jaden, who eats it like a house. If ice cream messes you up, probably not something you want to have. It's going to help have leaky gut. If it messes you with your digestion during the night, that can increase serotonin and all that stuff. So do easily digested foods, whatever that is for you. And probably, if you're going to do a big meal, probably space that out a couple hours before you go and lay down.
Yeah, definitely. Like having a giant steak before you go to bed isn't necessarily a good idea, because that takes a lot of energy to digest, and all that energy could be redirected into getting you prepared for sleep and, you know, sleeping throughout the night. One other point that I think is important to talk about in this episode specifically is, like, you know, if you are an athlete and this is your way of life, make sure that you've just thought about the decision that you're making, because like a lot of this stuff is, we're optimizing health for the everyday person, not necessarily for elite athletes. And if you are an athlete that is trying to, you know, become one of the elites, so to speak, just know that there are going to be health detractors that you're going to come across from a lot of this stuff. But also realize that there are a lot of psychological benefits from a lot of this stuff. You know, and if it's your way of life, then figure out how to mitigate the stressors as much as possible. And then, you know, you are going to have to deal with some health detriments along the way, but they're not necessarily going to be life threatening. Just know that they're there, and know what steps you can take to mitigate them as much as possible.
100%. And that's the point I was going to bring up as well. Like, Jane and I don't do jiu-jitsu or ski because we think it's the healthiest thing on the planet. We just enjoy these things. And so doing whatever you can to mitigate the distress, as we were talking about before, the unnecessary stress, and which jiu-jitsu is pretty much a whole unnecessary stress because we're really not trying to adapt to it, is going to allow you to be healthier and to continue to do the things that you love for as long as you can. And at the end of the day, life's short. It's all about doing what you can with what you got. So don't just because jiu-jitsu and running and whatnot is not perfect doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means that maybe you should take an extra step to decrease the amount of negatives that occur with it. And we also got to talk about those psychological benefits. Like, doing what you love has benefits that probably can't be measured.
Yeah, so. Absolutely, especially on the physical level too, because there are, like with the psychological payoffs, there are definitely physiological payoffs as well that come from that. So keep that in mind too.
Yes, sir. I think that's about it. Anything else you got?
Nope, that's all I got. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to y'all next time.
Have a good one. Peace.